I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The new century version of that 1980s classic, Getting to Yes, is about getting beyond yes, getting beyond no, getting toward understanding. Our guests from the Harvard Negotiation Project call their next release Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. It's about thinking like a mediator instead of a gladiator. If you approach conflict knowing you're right and he's wrong, or she's wrong, you're guilty of the truth assumption. If you're focused on whose fault it is, you're stuck in the blame frame. Our guests say there's more here than meets the ear. Think about having a learning conversation, not just a battle of messages. Connection listeners, what are the most difficult conversations you've had, and what were the outcomes? Do you have a difficult time talking to your spouse, your boss, your landlord, or the person across the counter? Can you imagine negotiating with feelings? Or does that begin to sound too touchy-feely for you? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255, or 1-800-423-TALK, to make the Difficult Conversations connection with Bruce Patton and Sheila Heen of the Harvard Negotiating Project, co-authors of Difficult Conversations. 1-800-423-8255. Bruce, give a clear example of a difficult conversation in which getting to yes is either not the way or not enough.
Well, one example was a student who said he wanted to talk to his younger brother about his drinking, his drug use, his violent temper when he was playing sports. And he thought he could really help his younger brother out. And every time he tried to play that, you know, let's talk, you know, you could do a little better about this. You ought to watch your temper there. You don't have to win every game of golf. All he did was get his, you know, 16-year-old brother mad at him. And when you asked him, look, why do you really have to have this conversation? He said, oh, well, my brother really needs my help. Well, why is it important to you to give him help? And the answer finally for him was, because I feel like I've been a bad older brother, and I need my brother to love him. And that realization doesn't come out of getting to yes. I mean, it's yes, it's your interests. What are my interests at underneath it all? But you really have to work to figure that out.
What's the nature of that work? There's a lot of self-examination,
yeah,
and reflection on fraternity and your brother and drinking and violence and the conversation itself.
Most difficult conversations really revolve around what it means to you. Underneath it all, it's difficult because it's saying something about you that you haven't thought through how to deal with. And that's the work you have to do.
One of the key mistakes we make is that we think that difficult conversations are about the facts. So I walk in thinking, I know the facts, I know what happened, and I know I'm right. And the problem is that difficult conversations almost never revolve around facts. They revolve around judgments. It's not, you know, how much money should we put in retirement, how much money should we spend on advertising. There's not a yes-no answer to that question. It's all about what role money serves for each of us, what interpretations we have about what the market's going to do. Whenever a conversation is about money, it's not really about money. Money is a proxy for security, for autonomy, for status. And it's what money means to us that motivates us to engage in the conversation.
Sheila, give an example. I want to come back to the brother who's drinking or drugging and violent is a classic. I mean, it has a whole lot of issues in it. But suggest another one, a kind of difficult conversation in which getting to yes is not what it's about.
Getting to yes talks about problem solving and, in doing so, separating the people from the problem. So rather than being adversaries, you and I engage as partners in tackling the problem together. And difficult conversations ask the question, well, what if the people are the problem? What if our relationship is so strained? What if emotions are running so high that we can't engage in problem solving together?
And even when it's not that bad, people still don't have the skills when there's a lot at stake. So an example would be two managers who are trying to decide whether to shut down a plant. And one of them is the accountant and says, look, if you run the accounting numbers, it really makes sense. And the other one's a former plant manager in charge of the division. And he says, we both know the accounting numbers don't mean anything. As a plant manager, I can tell you, we'll save money if we shut down this plant. And they can argue until the cows come home without ever coming to understand the validity of the other side's point of view. And that also, I mean, it's the idea of getting to yes. They should figure out why they see it differently, but they can point to their objective standards and still not get to getting inside of each other's story. Well, it turns out they both know something that the other one doesn't know, and they're not asking any questions of each other because they're not curious. They think they're right. They already know they're right.
Sheila, I want to go back to you for an example. I want you to play out the notion that it's never about money. Take a dispute. It could be between, you know, a multi-million-dollar athlete over a contract. It could be about Dilbert, you know, looking for something better than $29,000 in his cubicle or
yep.
whatever.
Yep.
You say it's not about money. Imagine the conversation, say, between Dilbert and his boss. What is it about, and how do you get there? How do you start talking about it?
Well, one of the reasons why asking for a raise is so anxiety-producing for many people is because it's not the money that's on the line, it's your self-image. We talk about part of what's going on is grappling with what we call your identity conversation. What you're afraid of is that your boss is going to say, you know, look, frankly, we haven't been that happy with your work this year. We don't think you deserve a raise. And suddenly my self-image as a star performer or someone who gets to be righteously indignant because I'm, you know, underpaid, is threatened. So our recommendation is that you first do some work with your identity conversation, looking at, well, what haven't I done so well this year? Let me get a grip on why I think I deserve a raise and some of the counterarguments for, you know, why I haven't been a perfect employee so that I can go in well-grounded and accept, yeah, I wish I had done that differently. Here's what I learned from it, and here's why I still think I deserve a raise.
We should both go back to the family scene. The older brother of the 16-year-old who's concerned about the kids drinking, drugging, tendency to violence. Could you stage that? Can you imagine?
Sure.
Do you want to be the older sister here?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I play that role well.
But the assumption is here there's interest, there's affection, there's devotion.
There's guilt.
Right.
On my part. I haven't
okay.
been as good a sibling as I
There's you been. Talking to yourself. There's you talking to him. What would it sound like?
Well, let me say a little bit about some key mistakes that I
How violent does Bruce get?
You know, he punched a hole in the wall.
But I'm a good kid.
Most of the time. You just don't realize, you know, that the world out there isn't going to protect you, Bruce.
Well, look, you know, my older siblings have all been stars. They're my parents' favorites. They were both valedictorians. They've gone to really good schools on scholarship. I struggle with dyslexia. I'm never going to be a star like them. I don't get much attention.
So here are three key mistakes for me, if I'm trying to have this conversation.
Sounds like you're always right, Sheila.
Well, I am always right. And I'm making the mistake of thinking this is about right or wrong. And I feel secure that I'm right because, of course, he shouldn't be drinking and doing drugs. And, you know, I have all sorts of evidence for why that's a bad thing. The mistake is that that's not what this...
I don't drink that much.
This conversation is about from Bruce's point of view. It's about, do I get to make my own choices or do I get bossed around by my older sister? It's about, do you trust my judgment? It's about, do you care about how I feel and what drives me?
What does your sister really care anyway?
Well, that's the second piece, which is the second piece of this conversation is about feelings, how we're each feeling treated in the relationship, how we felt in the past, and the mistake we
but
often
you're pretty
make,
safe in your old world. Maybe you're just preening your magnificent record here.
And that's a temptation for me. I mean, this is a real blot on my record that I can't seem to manage this relationship well. And that brings us to the identity conversation, which is who am I if I'm not the star who handles all her relationships well? And who everybody loves and respects. So I need to do some grappling in each of those. And if I'm going to have this conversation differently, should we take a crack at it?
Sure.
Okay. Now, it's not going to go perfectly because I know my brother. you know, Bruce, I've been thinking a lot about the way our relationship has been going and these conversations we have over and over about, you know, you're drinking.
You got to stop telling me what to do. I got to live my own life. You know, get over it.
So it sounds like you feel like I'm trying to live your life for you?
You're trying to tell me what to do. You're not my parents. You're my older sister.
So say more about that.
Just leave me alone.
Here's the dilemma for me, Bruce. It's not that I want to control your life or tell you what to do. It's that I'm really worried about you. And I feel like I haven't handled our relationship so well in the past. And I'd like it to be better. It makes me really sad that we can't seem to get along.
Well, I'm sorry you're sad.
How do you feel about it?
Remember, I'm 16.
You know, I remember times when we got along really well. And
what do you want from me?
I guess I want you to talk to me. And I don't think I do a good job of inviting that, because I'm always giving you advice rather than asking you questions.
You want me to talk to you?
Yeah. I mean, what? Why do you get so angry? Or drink?
I don't know. There's a lot going on.
Like what?
There's a lot of pressure.
From mom and dad or from school?
I don't know.
Let me just break in here for a moment to comment on it, which is, this conversation doesn't happen in a few minutes. It's going to be an ongoing conversation over time, and part of what I need to struggle with is being patient.
And one of the things you said that really started to get me going is when you said, you know, I'd like to hear. It was close to saying, I need you to do something. My older sister's never needed me for anything. In fact, we spent the last 4 years growing up with her trying to say, get lost, leave me alone, stay out of my face with my friends.
He was a pest.
Right?
At what point, Bruce, do you get a chance to say, wait a sec, maybe this is not about me or my drinking. Maybe it's about you.
If I were a
sister.
Really clever 16, yeah, I don't think this is about me at all. I think it's about you. You're trying to feel good about being such a bad person.
How do you really feel, Bruce? Okay, go ahead.
You know, Bruce, I think that's right in part. That this is about the fact that I feel badly about the way that I've treated you. And I'm not asking you to fix that. That's something that I need to accept about myself. But in accepting it, it's something I also want to change. And I need your help to do that because old habits die hard. So I'm going to leap to give you advice quickly. And I need your help in stopping me.
What do you want me to do? Because that would help.
Just remind me of this conversation.
All right.
It's hard because you just asked me for advice.
Well, a different kind, though.
That's true.
I think it would help a lot if you stopped giving me advice. I hear that you want to be there for me.
Yeah. It would help me if you'd stop needing
think about
advice.
That.
It's hard for me to watch you make some of the same mistakes that I did. They just weren't quite so public. You know, it wasn't so
see,
open.
See, that's back about you again. That's you being embarrassed for me.
It's me being worried. And I'm not asking you to solve my worry, but I think it's important you know that that's part of what I'm struggling with when I want to give you advice.
I can understand that.
Bruce, I think you've got a fabulous
sister
here. Work with it. Work
I don't
with
know,
it.
Man.
See, I'm right.
1-800-423-8255.
I want to know what you fed her.
Yeah, she's well fed. On her own.
What are you saying? This is radio.
No, she's there. She keeps saying these things that I wish I could say to folk. This could be interesting.
It's hard.
We're doing difficult conversations made easy. Not made easy, made interesting with Bruce Patton and Sheila Heen of the Harvard Negotiating Project. Difficult conversations. How to discuss what matters most. 1-800-423-8255. Anne is calling from a car phone.
Yes. I had an interesting situation that I was able to resolve satisfactorily. I was in the middle of a divorce with somebody who was very hard-nosed, and we'd been married for 26 years, and he just was not going to give in to anything. And we were constantly at odds, and we could not seem to come to an agreement until finally we had hired our own lawyer, but we also had a mediator. And the mediator finally said, look, we're going to have one mammoth session. We're not going home until this is resolved. So we set a date, and it had to start around lunchtime because everybody was busy up till then. And I brought a picnic lunch with all his favorite foods. I brought fried chicken and potato salad and rolls. This is a man who last year actually literally ate himself to death. So I knew that this is the way to get to him. So I brought all that stuff. I fed him well, and by the time it was over, I had everything I wanted.
That's getting to own it all. That's not...
Yeah,
that's
knowing your opponent.
Getting to win.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, I raised four kids, and I found that an awful lot of the time you have to bite your tongue and keep loving them and telling them that you love them, but bite your tongue and don't say anything.
Whatever you say, say nothing.
That's right.
But, Ann, wait a sec. I mean, that is the alternative temptation, sort of, hell with the difficult conversation. I just want to win. Is that enough?
And then in a divorce, in this divorce, he was trying to take everything.
Sure. And it's important not
nothing.
To... Yeah, it's important not to go along with that, for sure.
Right. I mean, I had been walked on for 26 years, and I was finally starting to stick up for myself, and I realized I was due something.
And every time, whenever people change the role that they've been playing in a relationship, other people push back, for sure.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, he was pushing back because all of a sudden I was sticking up for myself, but... The food sure did him in. It worked.
I think we're going to have to add a chapter to our book.
I'm never going to let you take me to lunch, Ann. Thank you.
Well, you know, could I say one other thing? Hello?
Yep.
Hello?
We had a rule in our house that we never discussed anything important on an empty stomach. There, you would be amazed at the difference in temperament before a meal and after a meal.
Sure. That's true for a lot of people.
People who sit down to dinner and immediately bring up something nasty, you have a problem. If you wait till after dessert, maybe you'll be able to manage it.
Consider that. If that gets into the second edition, we'll give you credit. thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Difficult conversations.
Divorce, Chris. You know, I mean, obviously this is a whole... nest of difficult conversations, and particularly people come to us and say, you know, how do I tell my kids that we're getting a divorce? This isn't a difficult conversation you can avoid.
And it's not a contest either.
Although people try to avoid it.
Right.
What are the rules here?
Well, one of the mistakes that people make is that you try to figure out some way to tell your kids so that they're not going to be upset. The drive to want to somehow control their reaction and the fear of, you know, what if they start to cry? What if they get angry at me? What if they, you know, withdraw or become devastated? Means that we try to minimize their reaction. Mm-hmm. So they start to get upset and we say, don't worry, everything's going to be fine. Well, they know not everything is going to be fine, that a lot of things are going to change.
Yeah, and that ends up either with them feeling like you don't understand them, or that you're telling them it's not okay to have their feelings, which it leads them to 20 years of therapy. And really, the desire to make it all okay has nothing to do with the kids. It has to do with you're feeling bad about yourself already, and if they get upset, you'll just feel worse. It's your own identity conversation that's out of control.
So the most caring thing that you can do for the kids is actually give them the space to have their reaction and to reassure them that you're going to be there with them.
For example, what does that mean? I brought the house down on our heads, and it's going to be awful forever.
Not forever.
Not forever. It's going to be hard for a while. And I feel sad, too. And I'm a little bit afraid, but I'm also confident that we're gonna survive this.
And one thing, and you can give them some perspective, and one thing you can know is that Mom and Dad are always going to love you. And that you've had nothing to do with, you're not the reason that this is happening. Sometimes big people have trouble maintaining their relationships over a period of time.
Okay. 1-800-423-8255. Difficult conversations, how to discuss what matters most. Diana is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Diana.
Good. Hello. Of course, it would be when I have to move the car. Okay.
Keep your eyes on the road. Okay.
I'll tell you. Well, I will tell you. Well, first, briefly, I want to say that conversation between sister and brother was great. As a recovering sister myself, I got to say, awesome.
Thanks.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. I'm kind of in the middle of an impossible conversation.
That's the next book. What's the difference between a difficult conversation and an impossible conversation?
Take difficult and, like, bring it to the 100th power, and that's impossible.
Okay.
Okay, it's Mother's Day.
Yep.
The last time I talked to my mom, we had a really huge fight because... My sister and I, in that order, remembered, well, we always knew we were abused. Okay, we always knew that something was wrong. We didn't call it abuse. And years later, we got memories.
Yep.
And my sister got them first. And so I actually went through the period of time of going, okay, you know, pissing off both sides by saying, well, if you're right, you know. But then eventually I got my own memories. So what we've got is my sister and I both quite certain that we have memories of some really bad stuff, which my mother was involved in. And my mother insisting that, well, she was there. That's her statement. She was there. She doesn't remember it. Therefore, it didn't happen.
Yep.
So we've been my sister doesn't talk to her anymore. My mom and I have been pretending that there's no problem. But the last time we talked, it's clear that we can't.
Right.
So now I'm trying to be efficient about this. So now we have Mother's Day. For years, I have called my mom on Mother's Day and on her birthdays and things like that, even though she's been sure every year that I'm not going to. Okay? Well, this may be the year.
She was the abuser?
Yes. One of. And so, you know, at this point, to tell you the truth, it's funny, our last conversation, she said, I couldn't have done that because I would have had to be psychotic. And the answer is, well, she is. So, I mean, she's crazy. She is. But she's not clinical. No one's put her away, but the woman's not. So what happens is, how do I talk to her?
Yeah.
Or can I talk to her, or can I not? Because, unfortunately, I can no longer have just pleasant conversations about how's our life going.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
and deny that there's something there.
You're illustrating.
What would the real conversation sound like, Diana?
The real conversation. Okay. See, it's funny because you know, I'm your thing about being right, right? I'm right. No. no. Okay. Here's the deal. I have memories. My sister has memories. I can understand you're not having them, but you're making a choice. You're making a choice. At this point, given that both of us have them, all I'm asking is that you consider the possibility that there's something there to remember.
Yep.
And problem is, I can kind of see what's going to happen. So part of me was wanting to write her a letter and say, look, Mom, I'm not calling you. Here's why. This
right.
is your choice.
Yep. Yep.
So
and any suggestions, I'm open.
Well, one suggestion would be that the temptation is to hold your purpose in the conversation as getting her to admit that you're right, or, you know, you're willing to settle for getting her to admit that there's some possibility that you're right.
Or that something happened.
Yep. And the problem is that you can't control what she chooses to believe. And so setting yourself up to try to accomplish something that's outside your control to get her to admit it is actually going to work against you, because the more you push, the more she's going to push back and resist.
Exactly.
Sort of despite any validity of the content. That's just the dynamic in the conversation.
Right.
And so what we would suggest, your story is a good example of where you have some multiple purposes. You actually don't want to cut your mother off. You have good feelings for her, and you have this very difficult piece that you can't ignore. And if you try and ignore it, you realize you just sort of cycle around not knowing what to do. We talk about, you know, using the word and. We call it the and stance. Things, mm-hmm. multiple things can be true, and that's what you can say here and speak just for yourself. Mom, I want you to know that I really appreciate many of the things that you did for me. And my sister and I have these memories, and for us it's very real that these things happened, and I hear that you don't remember that. It would be important to me that you acknowledge the possibility that it might have happened. And I want you to know that I feel very disappointed and hurt and so forth by, you know, these, by both the memories of what happened and that what did happen in my view and your inability to remember it. And I also want you to know I still love you.
And I don't know how to handle this while we're in the middle of this mess.
Yeah.
Because I feel so conflicted.
And. Tell her all.
All those things can be true at the same time. All those things are true at the same time. And so you're speaking much closer to reality than trying to push her to admit something that she genuinely, apparently, does not remember.
Or at least claims not to.
Or can't
yep.
remember.
Or can't
yep.
remember. Has
she's
blocked
not,
it out.
She doesn't know how to live with herself.
Could I ask you all, including you, Diana, definitely, are there... Other sibs.
I thought you wanted the other tab. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Okay.
You have a difficult conversation with your hand there?
Is there extended...
Yes, I owe somebody a big apology here.
Is there a father, extended family, other sibs, cousins and aunts that could help the thing without compounding the problem?
Well, as you may have noticed from the times you've done incest on the phone, it's not really, what's the word I'm looking for? A compromising thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like there are the people who are absolutely no way, and there are the people who are like, we believe you.
But here's a good example where whether it happened or not at this point, you know, you can't give conclusive proof of that. And the right or wrong of that isn't exactly what it's about. It's about what it means to each of you. You have the memories. To you, it's very powerful.
Uh-huh.
Your mother is unable to live with the possibility of what it would mean, perhaps, were it to be true.
Sure, I can accept that. Yep.
That's what it's really about. And I would, the other thing you might do, if you're up for it, is to ask your mother some questions. What would it mean to you to learn to remember this, if it turned out to happen?
Diana, thank you for posing the question. I think you've got to start at some answers here. We're talking about difficult conversations with Bruce Patton and Sheila Heen of the Harvard Negotiating Project. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about difficult conversations with a new generation at the Harvard Negotiating Project. The last generation gave us getting to yes. The new generation is giving us how to discuss what matters most. Let's put ourselves in a business negotiation. I've got a young internet company. You've got venture capital. You want us to sort of work on the conversation here, but I would just suggest two things. I mean, two alternatives. One, it's just about money. How much are you willing to put into my company for how big a piece of it? Other people that we've talked to recently would say it's not even about money. It's about testosterone. The one with the most testosterone, if you could test it before the meeting, and now you can, is going to win. You say... there's something in the quality of the conversation here.
Well, let me tell you what happens with small startups all the time. They're working very hard on a product. It doesn't go as well as they're hoping. In any project, something always goes wrong. At that point, the poor programmer says there's something going wrong to their boss. Their boss says, shh, don't say anything. Because why? If the venture capitalists find out, they'll pull the funding. They're funding us week to week. We can't tell them there's anything wrong. The venture capitalists desperately want to know that whether or not something's going wrong. And sometimes they do pull the money, even when they shouldn't, because they're unrealistically expecting nothing's going to go wrong. And by the time you do figure this out, it's when the product's being rolled out and it's got a fundamental flaw down in it somewhere. And then everybody, now we're locked in. That happens every single day for lack of a good conversation.
And as a result, everybody's looking for, well, who's to blame for this? Particularly in government, you know, if something goes wrong and it hits the papers, somebody's going to get fired. And the truth of the matter is, everybody involved in the situation had some hand in this problem perpetuating itself.
Right.
The venture capitalists perhaps weren't as realistic in their expectations, didn't ask enough questions, weren't on site. The programmer maybe didn't speak up loud enough or persistently enough or early enough. The managers, you know, tried to downplay the importance. And so if you're going to actually fix the situation, you need to look at what each person is contributing rather than spending your time in blame roulette trying to figure out, okay, who's going to get fired or whose fault is this?
Are you with me or are you not on the money, Mr. Venture Capitalist? I mean, let's not get too personal here. We can't talk about everything. Are you in or not? We've got a fabulous burn rate here. We're down the chute unless you were there with $15 million, and we're not going to give you more than 28% of the company. Yes or no?
Too simple a question. Because if you're going to push me, my answer is going to be no. if you're going to ask me what are my fears, what are my concerns, under what circumstances am I going to get nervous, then we're going to have a real conversation, and then I'm going to say, okay, I feel like you care about my concerns. I feel like I trust you.
Care, schmear. I mean...
No, and you get creative. You find some way to meet those concerns. A little reporting that otherwise, you know, I want to come to the meeting once a week to make sure the climate feels okay.
And care, schmear, there is an ethic in business that you check your feelings at the door. You proceed rationally, logically, and you pick your feelings up and take them home for your spouse to enjoy at the end of the day. And the truth of the matter is, when the conversation gets difficult, feelings are at the heart of the matter. Mm-hmm. It's how I feel treated in this relationship, and if I don't like the way I feel treated, I'm going to take my money and go home.
In money conversations, in how many of the money conversations can you say it's not about money?
Well, only dragons want to sit
us?
On their money. Dragons are the only thing that want to sit on their money. People want to use it for something. It's a counter for power, it's a counter for feeling status, or it's to go and do something interesting.
No, it's a question of, is my money going to be worth, you know, 30% more?
Is it a good investment? Sure.
Do I feel safe about my future? What is my fantasy future, and what role does money play in that?
But look, most mergers and alliances and joint ventures fail. They don't fail because somebody forgot to pay the investment bankers enough money to run the numbers. They don't, and everybody agrees on that. They fail because the relationships fail to work, because the cultures clash, and because all the people who thought everything, they agreed on everything, in fact, when they get down to deciding what to do, don't agree on what to do and can't work it out.
Hmm.
And sometimes it is testosterone. They can't decide who's going to be CEO or for how long. But it's still, they're talking about it as either or, yes or no, when it ought to be much more complicated.
Can you role play your way through a tense conversation about, you know, $15 million this week for 30% of the corporation? It's your company,
okay,
Bruce, and Sheila's got the money.
Bruce, frankly, I have to tell you that you were not happy with where the product is right now. You told us that it was going to be much further along, and I think we need to get this thing to market. Our burn rate is out of control, and I don't like the way the stock market is going. We're not in a little fantasy land anymore. This thing needs to work.
I think those are very important concerns, Sheila. Say a little more about what would look sensible. We have bumped into a problem we hadn't expected. It is one that I think we can get over, but let's talk about whether
you
agree.
What would be sensible to me is that the problem gets fixed tomorrow and we're to market on time next month.
Right, and what if that's not possible?
Then I'm starting to get very nervous.
You should be starting to get very nervous. I think there's reason for that.
So are you telling me I should take my money and go?
I think that would be unwise. You've got a significant sunk cost, and I think the question is, going forward, is it still going to pay off? I think it is, but let's take a look at the details.
What makes you so confident?
Well, I have a vision of how it's going to go, but I actually want to share that with you.
Okay.
Because you should check my reasoning.
I'm all ears.
Now, I don't have any details in my head, but we can keep going. If you
want.
But that's what I do. I'd go down. I'd get very concrete. Here's what I think is going to happen. How do you see it differently? In what ways do you see it differently? I actually want to know, because she may see something I'm missing. And I'm more likely to fix it now than later.
At what point would either of you dare to surface feelings? It's not about the market. It's about... Maybe,
well, it is partly about the market, but what's driving my concern for the market is my anxiety, both in terms of my reputation as a venture capitalist, that I've made a foolish decision and my judgment is perhaps impaired, that I wasn't courageous enough to cut it off when things got bad, so I rode it to the bottom. And Bruce is actually speaking to those fears by speaking to how confident can I be? Or are we in this together, and do I think his reasoning is right? And he is making that reasoning transparent so that I don't just have to trust him, I can see for myself why he's confident.
You said something earlier, Chris, that I think is very important. You said, you keep saying things that I wish I could say, but I'd never think to say. And that is a common experience that we have as people work through this material. It's not in the culture. It's with something that's not hardwired. It even goes against our hardwiring sometimes, because our hardwiring tends to be either or, fight or flight, right or wrong. And the world is more complicated than that, and we can learn it's more complicated than that. We can learn how to deal with it in the way that actually makes sense when you look at the situation. But we have to learn it. And we have to really practice being in a place where you say, well, look, maybe there's a reason you see it differently, because you may have different information. I don't know what your fears are until I really find out what they are. How would that play out? Say a little more about that. Is there any way that I could answer that? What if I could show you this?
And I think
What if people really want to learn? No, it's a fight or flight world. It's a win or lose world. I want to know when to fight and when to flight. You know, when to fly.
Some people do succeed looking at the world that way, but most analysts would say they miss an awful lot of opportunities.
Okay.
And a lot of people fail.
And they die young, alas. Yeah.
1-800-423-8255
makes the difficult conversations connection with Bruce Patton and Sheila Heen. Steve is on the line.
Hello, Chris.
Hi, Steve. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. And hello to Bruce and Sheila.
Hi.
I've been married for about 7 years. I've known my wife for 9 years. And I can't, in all that time, I can't ever seem to start to discuss any kind of marital conflict or emotionally charged disagreement without my wife getting kind of emotionally disabled. Withdrawing, starting to sob, sulk for hours, get angry. She doesn't seem to be able to accept the idea that we can have different viewpoints that are equally valid. It seems to be this either-or issue, like either you have a winner and a loser, a right or wrong situation. And, if you know, there doesn't seem to be much flexibility. So I guess what my question is, how can I start, put the framework into a different than either or, right or wrong, winner loser issue, so that maybe she'll be less.
How would you start a conversation like that? Now.
Right now.
Yeah. What might you say?
Well, I'd say something like I'd like to discuss an issue that we have different viewpoints on. You know, it usually doesn't come out that way because usually it's an impromptu thing.
Obviously. Usually it comes out more like, I'd like to discuss, you know, why you can't seem to keep your commitments and get home on time.
I'm not a very, I'm not that kind of person, really, that's very aggressive. I'm actually somewhat of a timid person. But these issues are almost trivial, like, should we go out to a restaurant tonight or not? You know, if we have a difference of opinion about it, it seems to lead to this horrible, situation where.
And whose restaurant do you go to in the end? Or do you stay home?
Well, I don't mind, have it going things her way, equally. It's no problem. But what's frustrating is that we can't seem to even discuss it.
Yeah.
Right. And this has been in marriage counseling as well. Even in marriage counseling, when the counselor tried to bring up issues that we have differences on, the same thing would happen. I mean, she just the idea that we can have differences seems to be. Provoke some kind of emotional charged reaction that is totally disabling to her.
Yeah. Well, my suspicion, by the way, you're a better person than I am in terms of starting it so unconfrontationally. I'm sitting here fearing my husband's going to call in and talk about my inabilities. But I think that probably part of what's going on is that the disagreement has some meaning for her that threatens the relationship itself. That for whatever reason, from the relationship she observed growing up as a child, you know, previous relationships in her life, you can't disagree without causing a crisis. That in order to have a good relationship, the definition of a good relationship is that we agree on everything, we never have any conflict at all. And that's a common misperception, which is that a healthy relationship is one without conflict. A healthy relationship, all relationships have conflict. The question of the health is how you handle them. And it sounds, Steve, like you're trying hard to handle them well, but she doesn't want to talk about it at all.
I can imagine starting this conversation, Steve, actually by saying something about what it means to you not to be able to talk about these things. And how important that is to you in terms of feeling like there's a real relationship there. I desperately want to have a relationship with you where I can share what's really going on with me. And sometimes what's going on with me is I have different views or different preferences than you. And it feels to me like if we can't talk those out, then we do have a problem in our relationship. And it seems like to you it means something very different. And I'm wondering, we've had this problem, but I've never really heard what it is.
Steve, could you get that far in the conversation?
That's a good point. A good question. I'll have to. Maybe I should we should discuss first before mm-hmm. we even discuss any particular issue.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And probably we should discuss this when we're not just trying to deal with a conflict at all. You know, maybe we should discussing when we're not in a charged situation.
Good. You could ease into it by saying, you know, sweetie, do you ever listen to that radio program, The Connection?
I happen to have a tape here.
Steve, thank you, and good luck. 1-800-423-8255 makes the difficult conversations connection. Veronica is calling from a car phone.
Yes, hi. I have a family issue myself, and it's kind of a little unique in that I have been pressed by my family members, my in-laws, in fact, to approach a sister-in-law and explain to her that we all feel that her young son is not progressing with his language skills the way that we all feel he should be, and that he needs some early intervention.
Is he 6 months old? Or?
He's approaching 2 years old. And I think that the family is quite right. He definitely
give him a break.
Well,
these days.
He definitely does need, I think, some assistance. I think that we've seen some difficulty and some frustration on his part. The question is, as the sister-in-law, I'm working on relationships across the board here with all of these family members. I've been married now into the family for a couple of years. So I have the relationship with my sister-in-law that I want to try to foster. Everyone is afraid to approach her and broach this subject. I have my mother-in-law who's pressing me into service, who's trying to get me to make this conversation. And the fact is, I am a speech-language pathologist, and so I'm the best person to make this, have this conversation. And I feel as though, in a way, I do feel responsible to have it. But my question really is, how do I, I'm trying to please everyone and also not burn bridges with my sister-in-law, who I think I'm afraid I don't know well enough to know how she's going to respond. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily, I think I might need to just sort of plunge in and try
in a professional
way, but it's kind of a tough one.
It may take a round or two for her, because she may be worried about it in some way. Mm. It sounds like you have a series of difficult conversations that you might want to engage here, like, you know, with everyone who's saying, oh, you're clearly the person to do it.
Well, I was just going to say, there's an expertise question in here. This is my field, so I've got to assert myself. Well, maybe it's not a question of expertise, Veronica, at all.
Maybe the mother-in-law should start the conversation and suggest that her daughter talk to you because you have the professional expertise.
Also, I mean, Veronica, if I may say, I hear a bell ringing when you say, I feel responsible for, you know, a two-year-old's speech development. I mean, who's responsible here?
Well, I guess I feel responsible as a professional person to give advice if it's asked of me, particularly from my family. I do think that they would look to me for that kind of assurance that are we seeing what we think we're seeing? And my feeling is that they're right. They are seeing some difficulty. And as I've admitted that, now I feel like, okay, I do feel responsible to the family to say something to my sister-in-law.
But wait a minute. It's one thing to reassure your family that there's a problem. It's another thing then to have to be the one to raise the conversation.
And that should
depend on your relationship.
Right.
Veronica, do you personally think that he needs a little bit of help?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so don't speak for the family.
Right.
Speak for yourself. And going to your sister-in-law to say, you know what, I am noticing a couple of things. I don't know if you're noticing them also, but it occurs to me that, you know, little Toby, or whatever his name is, might be experiencing something that a lot of kids go through.
Mm-hmm.
And he's having trouble with the following things. But I don't know. You know, obviously you know him better than I do. What do you think?
Right.
And it's very important that you not approach it from, you know, look, this kid has a problem and you're in denial.
Right.
Because the parent's identity as a good parent is very much put on the chopping block in any conversation about parenting and dealing with kids and problems. As the parent of a 10-month-old, I can tell you that straight out.
Exactly. And in my professional capacity, I think I have enough finesse to know how to, you know, approach a parent and sort of begin that conversation. I think that it's loaded in this situation because I have a feeling my sister-in-law might guess that I've been sort of put up to it family, you know. And but I think that you're right. I think that the thing that I have to do is drop away any responsibility I feel to my mother-in-law and the rest of the family and just use this opportunity to maybe, you know, promote my relationship with my sister-in-law a little bit and just get closer to her and give her the opportunity to express some fear and treat her as if she were a special client to me and forget everybody else.
One other phrase you used, Veronica, I just want to bring up. You worried a little bit about burning bridges. What's to do with that anxiety?
It's a very, very common fear. If I raise this issue, it's really important to me, I may jeopardize the relationship. They may get angry, start to cry, etc. And it's the simple uncertainty of not knowing what they're going to do that is often part of the difficulty.
It reminds me of what you said earlier about the parents telling their kids that they're getting divorced and trying to control the reaction. I've seen parents react in ways that are so negative to this kind of information. I don't want to have that kind of encounter with my sister-in-law.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And the way that you raise it is going to raise or lower the risk that you're going to get a bad reaction.
The thing people often overlook, though, is if you don't raise it, you still will have an awkward relationship with your sister-in-law because you'll be thinking this and not talking about it, and that gets in the way, too.
All the best, Veronica. Thank you for sharing. 1-800-423-8255. Mel is on the line. Hello, Mel.
Yeah, hi.
Greetings.
Yeah, I would be interested in the two authors sharing with us a case where someone uses these very wonderful diplomatic techniques, and they really are terrific, it sounds like to me, with their boss. But their boss keeps talking, but nothing really happens. Nothing changes, no attitudes change. And, of course, the boss has the power.
What kind of officer or factory or job are we talking about?
Like the Patriots. You know, it's been in the papers. This coach who just was fired, it was known many of the players subverted his authority and went up the back door and spoke to some of the executives and told stories on him. It didn't respect his authority. So suppose he went and said, look, let's have a good conversation. What do you think of this? You see, we're a manager's supervisees are subverting their authority, so they speak to their boss, and the boss listens, and we have all a wonderful conversation, but nothing changes. And I guess I must say, in my experience in organizations in Massachusetts, authority and responsibility aren't equivalent. There's a tremendous problem.
Yeah, and I want to say...
And you could talk yourself blue in the face.
Yep.
It's not going to change.
Absolutely. So there are two questions that I hear you asking. One is, well, what if you have this great conversation and then nothing changes, even though they agreed with you all through the conversation? And I want to be clear that conversations are rarely one-shot deals and that then you need to have a second conversation. I don't understand. You know, we had this conversation. I told you sort of the impact of what you were doing had on me and things aren't changing. So what do I not understand? But the second piece that I think is important here is if you're the boss, well, gosh, then it's much easier to implement these skills. What if you are the subordinate and your boss not only doesn't care about all this touchy-feely stuff, hasn't read the book, and doesn't particularly even want to have the conversation? How do you use the skills with your boss when your boss isn't buying in? Why don't we do a quick example of that?
Super quick. All
right.
So we've got about...
Sheila's my boss.
2 minutes, which, you know, frankly...
Call it a minute.
All I've got is a minute. What's the deal? What's the problem?
What's the problem?
You packed the wrong overheads for my trip. I got there. It was very embarrassing. We may lose this client.
Sheila, I'm really sorry to hear that.
This cannot happen again. Do you understand how serious this is?
I do, and I've actually been thinking about it. It's very important to me, too, that it not happen again. I have some thoughts about that. I think probably it's going to take a little bit of help from you to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Well, you know, I don't know what more I can do.
Well, let me suggest. One of the things, you usually check your briefcase, double check it, and I think that would
be a
good thing to do always.
That's true.
I
didn't do that this time.
The second is I have trouble sometimes asking you. I had a question about whether these were the right overheads, and I was hesitating to ask because just at the last minute when I do ask those kind of questions, you often feel... tense, and I have trouble dealing with that. So in the future, if we can find some way to make it a little bit easier on me, or else maybe we're just not the right mix, and you and I should find another pairing.
Uh-oh. Yeah, Sheila. Yeah, Bruce. Watch out. It just occurs to me, and we don't sell books, but just what if people just gave this book to the person they want to talk with and said, think this one over?
Yeah. The publisher thought it was not going to be a gift book. It's turning into a big gift book.
Sheila Hain, Bruce Patton, thank you.
Thank you,
and
Chris.
To all the callers who make the connection every day. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
BRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the book The Best American Mystery Stories of the Century, edited by Tony Hillerman and series editor Otto Penzler. By Easter Seals, expanding independence for children at